WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. 32 million children participate in the National School Lunch Program. About two-thirds of them pay a reduced fee or nothing at all. Back in 2010, and driven by concern about childhood obesity and the poor quality of school lunches, Congress passed the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, mandating more fruits, vegetables, and whole grains and less sodium in school lunches. Well, today there's a fight in Congress over the school lunch program, with the School Nutrition Association, which had supported the new regs, wanting to give districts the choice to opt out a one-year waiver. I'll be talking with a representative from the SNA, but first our guest is Marion Nessel. She's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She's got a new book. It's called Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. Marion Nessel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, glad to be here.
So 4 years ago, there was bipartisan support for this bill. It got through the House. It got through the Senate. 4 years later, there is pushback. What has changed in the last 4 years from your perspective?
Well, I think the idea that, if you're going to do something about changing the meal patterns in schools, there are going to be winners and losers in that. And the losers are politically powerful and are exerting their muscle and have a Congress that has proven to be extremely amenable to those kinds of pressures and is very industry-friendly. And so I think we've seen a shift in the political climate so that all of a sudden the industries that feel that they're going to lose from the new school food rules are fighting back and dealing with their friends in Congress, and Congress is sympathetic.
And who are the losers? Who are the losers you're talking about?
Well, the losers, you mean the losers in the school food? These are the big companies that produce not particularly helpful foods that are sold in schools, and that will be that won't be there as a result of the change in the rules. The school food rules that were issued by the Department of Agriculture in 2012 limit the kinds of foods that can be sold in schools to those that meet certain nutrition standards. And the foods that don't meet those standards won't be sold in schools. And that includes foods that are extremely high in fat and sugar salt.
So we're talking things like chicken nuggets? I mean, that kind of thing?
Well, it depends on how they're made in the case of chicken nuggets, but it certainly would exclude full sugar sodas. That's the easiest example. The soft drink industries don't like that very much. And the producers of pizza, with very large amounts of cheese on it, also would be affected by that because there would be some limitations on what they could sell. And these industries have proven to be very adept politically. Remember pizza as a vegetable?
I do remember that.
That was from a couple of years ago when the company that provides pizzas for school lunches insisted that even a tablespoon of ketchup or of tomato sauce on the pizza would count as a vegetable when the Department of Agriculture tried to at least increase the amount of tomato sauce that would count. The companies went to Congress and complained, and Congress put something in an appropriations bill that would block the Department of Agriculture from making any kind of restriction on volume of tomato sauce or of potatoes, for that matter. They also wanted to limit potatoes to a couple of times a week instead of every day, because they're usually presented as fried potatoes. And here the potato industry objected, and that's what's happening again. It worked the first time. They're doing it again. Well, I think they can win, and they may be able to.
Well, I'm going to be talking with someone who's a member of the School Nutrition Association. How do you see that organization? And 4 years ago, they were in favor of these new regulations. Something like 19 past presidents are still in favor of it. But as of today, the SNA is in opposition.
Well, the School Nutrition Association is a very complicated organization, and it's quite divided these days. So it can't be looked at as an entity. It came out in support of the food industry position. It's an organization that is very, very strongly supported financially by the companies that make these foods. And it represents the members of the association who are working in schools that use food products much more than the people who are working in schools that actually do their own cooking. And there's a big difference in the quality of the food and the healthfulness of the food in those schools. But there are a lot of schools that don't have kitchens or, for some reason or other, are not doing their own cooking. And these schools are dependent on food products, and the food products are, often designed to appeal to children's taste. I mean, the question is here is who decides what a healthy diet is for kids? Do the kids themselves decide? Do the food companies decide? Or does the Department of Agriculture decide based on separate reports over a period of years from the Institute of Medicine?
There was a study, the Harvard University Public Health study, looking at what gets thrown out in school cafeterias. Something like 65 to 75% of vegetables get tossed. About 40% of fruit gets tossed. Apparently, this has always been the case. But aren't we at a point in 2014 where you can make healthy food that the kids actually want to eat?
Oh, you absolutely can. And I love going around to schools and doing observations. I live in New York City, and I've been taken to a great many schools in New York City, some of which are doing an absolutely fantastic job of producing healthy, delicious food for kids with very, very little plate waste. I've also been to schools in New York City where that's not the case, and I've concluded as a result of that that this is very person department. If I go into a school and see a school food service staff that is deeply committed to feeding kids healthfully and know the kids' names and are really involved with the kids in a very personal way around what they're eating, I know that those kids are going to be eating the food and the plate waste will be minimal. On the other hand, if I go into a school where the school food service personnel couldn't care less about what the kids are eating, the kids couldn't care less either. And I don't know how to, it's very hard to implement policy in places where what's happening is so person-dependent. And I don't know how else to explain it except that it's extremely personal.
Do you have any sympathy for some of the districts that are saying it's more expensive for us to abide by these regulations, and we've got shrinking budgets, we're trying to stretch our education dollars across all the things that happen in the school, and we just can't afford these regulations?
Yeah, I have total sympathy with that. And the only thing I can say is that there are ways of dealing. You have to cook in the schools if you really want to be able to do a good job on the amount of money that's available. And if you do cook and you're not using more expensive pre-processed foods, you can do it. But not every school has the ability to do that. And on the other hand, the Department of Agriculture is more than willing to work with the schools that are having trouble doing this to try to find ways in which they can do a better job of it. The Department of Agriculture is totally open, and publicly and privately, to working with schools to try to make this work. But you have to have two sides. You have to have people who want to make this work and an agency that wants to make it work. And when that is, when that's happening, it's working. But when I see the kinds of complaints that are coming, those complaints are realistic. They have an enormous grain of truth in them. But if there's a real commitment to make this work, somehow it happens.
Well, which leads to a question about, isn't there some kind of compromise that can be, we're talking about healthy foods for children going to school, growing bodies, and somehow this has become a divisive, even partisan issue. Do you see a way through that, Marian Nessel?
Well, I'm astounded by the partisan issue about it. I mean, what could be better than feeding school kids healthy food? I just can't imagine that this would be politically controversial. But we are in a political climate in this country right now where anything that is going to affect the bottom line of a corporation is something that has tremendous tremendous partisan political implications. And that's what's happened here, is that this has been completely politicized because of the money that's involved.
The SNA says, look, we just want a one-year waiver for those districts that are having a hard time, you know, finding the extra money to pay for these new regulations. Do you see a one-year waiver as a kind of Trojan horse sort of opening up this bill that was passed 4 years ago?
Yeah, I most definitely do, because if a school is having trouble, that school can contact the Department of Agriculture and negotiate. And the Department of Agriculture is willing to negotiate with schools that are trying to do the best job they can. It's been doing that. So the idea of having a one-year waiver sounds to me like, how about a two-year waiver, especially since the members of Congress who have gotten involved in this have made it very clear that they would like the whole enterprise to just go away. Now, mind you, this is not something that the Department of Agriculture just dropped. The Department of Agriculture started working on these rules in 2007. There have been several Institute of Medicine, very carefully done scientific reports on what ought to be done in the school meals program. It took years before the rules were issued. There were more than ample time for schools to comment and think about it and work on it. This is not something that came from outer space. It's been worked on for years. So to have this kind of opposition at this late date, I mean, it seems like sour grapes to me. And, you know, you hate to think that an organization has been bought by its corporate sponsors. And it's certainly not completely bought, because 19 past presidents of the School Nutrition Association have come out in favor of keeping the rules the way they are. So this is a deeply divided organization.
We have to take a very short break in about a minute, but is there some flexibility in these regulations? Do schools have some ability to play with what the regs say?
The Department of Agriculture says yes. The School Nutrition Association says no. I don't know how you deal with figuring out what's going on in a situation like that, but I have no reason to believe that there isn't flexibility when there's evidence of a sincere commitment to try to meet the regulations and do a good job of them.
Well, we're talking with Marion Nessel, the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, about the fight over the school nutrition, school lunch program, I should say. She's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. Her new book is Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. And we want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be talking with Marion Nessel for about five more minutes. Then we'll be talking with Jonathan Dickel, and he's a Southeast Regional Director of the School Nutrition Association. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the Museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
In an operating room, you can cut the tension with a scalpel.
Have a 60cc syringe, please.
Did you inject already?
Yeah.
So sometimes, surgeons need to take the edge off the OR, and the Rock Doctors think they have just the thing.
This week on Sound Opinions, we help a fellow physician find the perfect surgery soundtrack.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or were the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Marion Nessel about the fight over the school lunch program. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Marion, in preparation for the show, I was thinking about the school lunches that I ate as a kid growing up. And, you know, we used to talk about things like mystery meat. And it seems that school lunches have often had this kind of bad reputation among children.
Well, I think that's always been the case, and any institutional food is going to, you know, it's one of those things you love to hate. I see this at New York University, which, as far as I can see, has perfectly fine variety and quality of food in its cafeteria, and the students still complain about it. So that's inherent. On the other hand, if the kids are eating the food, that's a real indication that things are going just fine. And I've been in schools in some of the poorest school districts in New York City, you know, where all the kids are low income and basically all of the kids qualify for free and reduced price meals. And you walk into the cafeteria and it smells good and the kids look happy and the school food service personnel know the names of the kids and say, oh, I've just made this specially for you today. You're really going to like it. And the kids are eating the food and the plate waste is minimal. And it's a program that's working. Mm. It looks fine. On the other hand, I've been in schools where that was not the case. And my indicator, and this is completely ridiculous, but it works, my indicator of whether a school food program is working is whether the school food service personnel know the names of the kids.
That's interesting.
And, you know, if there's a real involvement and a real commitment, somehow it works. And so when I hear people complain that this is impossible, they can't do it, I wonder where the adults are. I mean, that's really my question, is who are the adults who are there? Who's really there trying to make it work? Because if they are, then the Department of Agriculture is happy to work with them to try to get through this bumpy transition to a place where things are working okay, and the Department of Agriculture says that the schools that started working on this a couple of years ago and used the new school food rules as an excuse to do what they've been wanting to do all along are not having any problem implementing the rules. It's the schools that haven't been involved in it and have been dragging their heels that are having the problems. And this is not to say that the financial problems aren't horrendous. They are. But somehow there are schools that are that can make this work, and there are consultants who can show schools how to get more money out of the system. I mean, there really are schools that are committed to do this can do this.
And we have to say goodbye to you in about 30 seconds or so. But do you think it's possible to have home cooked food for 32 million children every day?
Well, I'm not sure it's home cooked, but somehow on a school by school basis, if you schools aren't dealing with 30 million. They're dealing with hundreds or sometimes thousands of kids. And yes, they can do it.
Well, on that.
But.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Requires some imagination and some commitment. And I think it's a commitment well worth making.
Well, Marion Nessel, thank you so much for getting our conversation started. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And she's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her new book, again, Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. We are talking about the fight over the school lunch program. And joining us now is Jonathan Dickel. He's Director of School Nutrition for the Knox County Schools in Tennessee. He's also the Southeast Regional Director of the School Nutrition Association. And Jonathan Dickel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Help us understand. We're up here in Philadelphia, the Knox County Schools in Tennessee. What kind of, how many schools and what part of Tennessee?
We are in eastern Tennessee. We have 85 sites where we feed kids, and we serve 59,000 students a day.
And have you found that you've been able to abide by these regulations from the USDA?
Well, you know, first thing I want to say is I completely agree with Ms. Nessel. I mean, we should be offering students healthy school meals, and as an early adopter, we take great pride in serving nutritious meals in Knox County school cafeterias. Our students choose from 3 to 5 kinds of fresh whole fruit every day, and we also serve 4 vegetable choices. We do 2 hot vegetable choices and 2 cold vegetable choices daily. Many of these are local grown, and we've made tremendous progress transitioning to lower sodium and whole grain foods. We're thrilled that so many of these changes that we've made in our schools have been accepted by our students. In fact, we've even started to implement some of the practices that Cornell recommends, which I know So we've seen some great response in student acceptance of fruits and vegetables as a result of implementing the Cornell process. But let's be honest here, though. The students in Knoxville and communities across the country aren't encountering whole grain biscuits and low-sodium sandwiches when they go out to restaurants. And many of these aren't seeing the same choices at home either. You know, we're asking school cafeterias to lead the way in changing the eating habits of America's children, and we're expecting them to do it on a budget of about $3 per lunch, which is less than most adults pay for their morning latte. It takes time for students to adjust to changes, and we need school cafeterias to have flexibility to plan menus to ease these students into healthier diets.
Well, could it also be argued that schools are places where children go to learn, and they go to learn math and English and history, but also a place where children can go to learn about nutrition, about healthy eating, about how to make healthy choices?
Oh, yeah, and I agree. And one of the things that we locally here in Knoxville are very much, we devote a lot of our resources to nutrition education. We have an in-house nutrition educator. But our association has been leading the way in trying to focus on nutrition education. And we've done things like we do student taste tests, we do chef partnerships, Harvest of the Month programs, farm-to-school initiatives. We work on training our association members on to be able to use nutrition education components in the classroom. There's all kinds of curriculum for us to be able to implement and use. We also look at our cafeterias themselves as opportunities for educating students about items that they may not have ever had before. So you'll see items that are becoming more popular. We'll do work with kale. We've done work here in Knoxville. So we've served things like jicama and kohlrabi and some other things like that, just trying to show them some new items. We try to encourage them, even if they won't take it the first time, we try to encourage them to do like a two-bite club where they might take us a little sample or a little taste of it so that they can try something new. And our kids are doing really well with the guidelines in place as we have them, and really what SNA is advocating is an opportunity for folks to catch up before we go into the next phase. We're already at the point of phase one on sodium. We're already at phase one on whole grains, and so we would just like some time for others to catch up. And Ms. Nessel herself said about folks being able to grow in acceptance and grow in transitioning in some of these changes and the culture of change and trying to implement those changes. So it is a very challenging process right now for many districts across the nation.
But it sounds like you're also saying that if you had more than $3 per child per meal, that schools could do more?
Well, you know, right now what we're seeing is many of the districts had an initial drop in participation when they implemented the change in standards. We adopted early, so our drop, we were kind of flat. We really didn't have much of a decrease in participation here in Knox County. But many folks did have a decrease in participation. You couple that with rising costs, and I use the term perfect storm because this really was a perfect storm. We had the new regulation requirements to require us to have students take a half cup fruit or vegetable. We had the requirements of whole grains, which whole grains are more costly to purchase than less healthier options. And so we had that happen. We had drought conditions. We had the rising cost of grains and now the rising cost of proteins. So right now, overall, and every person out there on the radio knows that, and the audience knows that when they go to a grocery store, it's costing much more to buy those same items in the grocery store. It's hard to buy a piece of fruit in the grocery store for under a dollar. We've seen our costs double in the cost of fresh fruit. And so all those costs associated the USDA provides us about something that stays in line with consumer price index. We usually get about 3% annually to increase to cover our increased cost for a meal. Well, you can see that with such dramatic things that have happened over the last 2 years, many, many districts nationwide are struggling financially to make ends meet. And we couple that with a rising cost of equipment, rising cost of insurance. It's becoming a very, very difficult mm-hmm. time for us to be able to meet our nutritional and financial requirements. And majority of the school districts nationwide operate financially independent from their school district. Like here, it's my mandate that I don't ever go to my superintendent for money, that I can operate financially independent. And so what's going to happen and what has had happened in some programs nationwide is that they're starting to have to supplement some of the cost of operating the program instead of the program being financially on its own.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Jonathan Dickel. He's director of school nutrition for the Knox County Schools. That's in Tennessee. He's also Southeast Regional Director of the School Nutrition Association, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times as we talk about the political fight that has developed over the school lunch program. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Jonathan, let me just get you to respond to some of the criticisms of the School Nutrition Association. 19 past presidents oppose the waivers that the SNA is asking for now. It has been accused of being in the pocket of the food industry and getting some of its, or about half of its money from agribusiness and some of these large food processing corporations. What's your response to that?
Okay, so the first concern that you mentioned was the concern about this being a political battle. And, you know, we're all disappointed that this has become a political battle. The School Nutrition Association wants to work with government leaders. We all share the same goals. We all want to make sure kids are eating healthy meals that help them succeed in the classroom. I honestly, you know, believe that this is just an effort to try to, it's a divisive effort. It's trying to deride our efforts in trying to ensure that kids have access to healthy meals and our members are able to implement these changes in a timely and fiscally prudent manner. On the other hand, I know that several presidents have spoken up past presidents, and I love these ladies dearly. In fact, several of them are close friends, and we've had conversation about it. And people are not always going to agree on everything that an organization does. And in this situation, many of us, like I shared earlier, many of us have already implemented it and been able to make ends meet and to do it well. But there are many out there that aren't, and we have to represent the interest of all of our membership, and that's what SNA does. To try to tie us to industry, I mean, these speculations are false, and they really serve no other purpose than to politicize the debate and to take away from legitimate concerns that school nutrition professionals have. Ms. Nessel mentioned pizza, and that pizza
yes.
being counted as a vegetable
yes.
is just a couple years old. Pizza's been counted as a vegetable since the 70s. And in fact, in my last, we had to go through this review nationwide. All of us had to go through a review to see if we had implemented the new standards. And during my implementation process, I actually got a citation for not counting pizza as a vegetable because many of my counterparts don't count pizza as a vegetable. We think it's ridiculous. But that's just something that is being done to politicize this. Soda, under the Smart Snacks regulation, I have a 16-year-old son. He's going to be a junior next year in high school. Under the Smart Snacks regulation, I will no longer be able to sell him a fat-free 12-ounce chocolate milk with no high fructose corn syrup, but I'll be able to sell him a Diet Mountain Dew. Now, does that make any sense? So to say that this change in regulations is going to being powered by industry to me is just ridiculous. And then winners and losers.
Yeah, very quickly.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Very quickly, if you don't mind, I want to get a caller on, but go ahead.
Well, in regards to winners and losers, you know, I've got three friends I can reel off the top of my head. One of them's a director in Washington State. She just wrote into Food Management Magazine recently stating the fact that she lost 5% participation last year in her meals. And she's done a fantastic job. She's an early adopter of the changes, and she's done really well. On the other hand, but she's lost 5% of her participation. She's struggling to make ends meet. I have another friend of mine. She's been in the business for 30 years. She's a registered dietitian, has an EDS, smart, engaging person, loves her kids, has a good culture in her district, and she's had 2 years operating in the red, and she never operated in the red, so she's reaching out trying to get help. So those of us that are able to make ends meet are trying to work with her and trying to help her, which is what our association does.
Well, let me get, looks like David from King of Prussia to join our conversation. And David, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm curious about, all the talk is about providing food that the kids will eat, but nobody talks about trying to teach the kids what they should eat. I mean, they're exposed every day to television, which tells them to eat McDonald's. They love French fries and hamburgers. But in the classroom, they can be taught that vegetables are something they should eat. They might be asked after lunch who ate what. Nobody supervises their eating. My daughter-in-law is a teacher, and she has her bag lunch separately. She doesn't eat with the students. So there is the obvious thing to do with young children is to educate them, and we don't seem to do that. We seem to think that if we put food out, they'll eat it, but of course they won't. Someone has to tell them this is what you should eat and encourage them to do it, make it fun for them.
Well, David, we actually have a guest who can address that very specific point
that you
just raised. He's waiting in the wings, but let me give Jonathan Dickel a chance to respond to that. And we only have a couple of minutes, and if I can just toss this in on top of that, Jonathan, which is, I mean, it seems to me if we're talking about kids, we're talking about nutrition, we want healthy kids, we want them learning, we don't want them to have weight problems. There has to be some compromise here that everyone can sign on for.
Okay, so first I'd love to address, it's David, right?
It's David.
That call. I'd love to address what he said. You are absolutely right on target. This is my second state that I've worked in. I worked in Tennessee, and I also used to work in Florida. And in both states, we have worked hard to try to get our into the curriculum some form of nutrition education, maybe through our local wellness policy or actually talking to the state and trying to get it implemented through the state to try to be able to reach out to kids to get them to try new items. What we really have been doing the last few years is we've been really marketing more towards the kids, marketing healthier foods. We've got posters. We have purchased these special trays that that kids can that have more flash, and so that's not put out. Food's not put out on a sheet pan that was put in the oven. We really try to get the kids to taste new foods and try new foods, and our menu really reflects. We do scratch cooking, we do modified scratch, and we do some value added items. So we do a whole grain breaded white meat chicken nugget even, but we try to encourage the kids to eat things that are healthy while we also try to maintain student participation.
Well, on that note, I know we could go on, Jonathan, but we have to end our conversation. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jonathan Dickel, Director of School Nutrition for the Knox County Schools in Tennessee. We have another guest waiting in the wings, which is how you can change your cafeteria to get kids to eat. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Amtrak, featuring patripsbytrain.com, offering train packages to destinations along Amtrak's Keystone service line. More information on available excursion packages at patripsbytrain.com.
If I do my job perfectly, I will probably kill you.
On the next Fresh Air, Shep Gordon talks about his life as a Hollywood insider. After a chance encounter with Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, he became the manager for Alice Cooper, Blondie, and Pink Floyd. He's influenced countless stars and is the subject of a new documentary by Mike Myers, who also joins us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Too many times in the last few years, we've heard this similar story of tragic, unnecessary violence. But is there anything we can do to predict or change this violent behavior, or should we just give up and focus more on minimizing its deadly expression through controlling access to weapons? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, random mass shootings and what we can do to prevent them. Today at noon, here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with the all-new available 2.3-liter EcoBoost powertrain for the power and poise to handle any driving situation. More available at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. We've been talking about the fight over the school lunch program requirements passed by Congress in 2010 to make meals more nutritious. Critics say some of these regulations are just too costly and have led to a lot of uneaten and wasted food. The other side blames the food industry for putting profits over health. Well, joining us now, how giving kids choice and rearranging the cafeteria can lead to healthier eating. And our guest is David Just. He's director of the Cornell Center for Behavioral Economics and Child Nutrition Programs and a professor of behavioral economics at the Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University. And David, just a long introduction there. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. It seems to me that there's nothing new about children in the cafeteria at school. Tossing vegetables, tossing fruits, trading with each other for the most sugary snack. Are we at a turning point now where we actually know some things about how to get kids to eat healthier and want to eat healthier in the cafeteria?
But I've got to say, I think we're actually getting to a point where we're really starting to understand what sorts of things speak to kids when it comes to healthier foods. And we do have a lot more options available to us than we had in the past to try and lead them to choose those healthier foods. So I come at this from behavioral science, and you know, for a long, long time, we had a caller who asked about nutrition education, and a long, long time, the theory was all, let's teach them what's good. And that didn't seem to make much difference, and it shouldn't surprise us too much. It doesn't work very well with adults either. We know what's good for us, but we tend to, you know, favor the chocolate cake rather than the celery, right? And the same thing happens with kids. Whatever seems to be sort of immediately available and is going to get them, the type of taste they want right now, that's really what they're going to be looking for. It's trying to work within that framework to get them to choose healthier foods and making those more appealing for them. That's what can work.
Well, and the operative word is choose, yes? Children
absolutely.
Want choice. I mean, that should not surprise us.
This is absolutely the case. Each one of us has this sort of, you know, innate rebellion against any sort of threat to our freedom.
Exactly.
It's, you know, psychologists call it reactance, right? With kids, it's particularly acute. It's something that, it drives their behavior, much of their behavior throughout the day. And so if they feel like you're threatening them or you're pushing them, you have to eat this, they're going to push back at it. There's a wonderful example from a school nearby here where they had limited kids to eat, take one packet of ketchup with their lunch. One packet of ketchup because they were worried about the added sugar, right? And that doesn't sound like it's so ridiculous to an adult maybe, but to the kids it sounded absolutely ludicrous. You can't cover two tater tots with that. And they got angry, and they organized a protest, and the protest was sort of innocuous. Graduation comes along, and the seniors each hand the principal a packet of ketchup as they're walking across the stage. And, you know, that's a little bit silly and yeah. Not a lot of damage, but what does it say? It says you haven't won their heart or their mind, right? And when they're going to McDonald's, they're not taking one packet of ketchup and saying, those nice people at the school told me I should only take one. They're grabbing handfuls and handfuls because now they're free. Now they can do whatever they want, right?
So how would you suggest then, let's say, even redesigning a cafeteria line as a child picks up a tray? And actually our previous guest talked about having kind of nice-looking trays that are attractive to the children. How would you rearrange even the assemblage of food there so that they might happily and healthfully choose a nutritious meal?
We've got to go in there and we've got to think about how a thoughtless decision maker makes decisions. And typically they go in and they don't have any idea what they want when they walk in, and they take the clues from the environment around them. So you make the things you want them to choose very visible, you make them very convenient to grab, and you make them somewhat attractive or exciting. And you know, there's some simple ways you can do that. The example that I always use is, you know, if you go into the average school, you have fruit sitting out in a stainless steel bin and it's sitting underneath a sneeze guard. It's not well lit. It doesn't look attractive. It's hard to reach. You take that same fruit, you put it in a wire basket near the cash register where it is well lit and it's easy to reach, and you get about a doubling of kids actually eating fruit.
Marion Nessel was our first guest talking about some of the schools that she has visited, and what she observed is that when the people who work in the cafeteria, who are serving the food, when they know the children's names, when they feel like they have a relationship, maybe even they know what they like and don't like, she saw more healthy choices. Does that make sense to you based on your research?
Oh, it's absolutely the case. And we actually have some nationwide data we've got to back that up. And it doesn't necessarily, we don't have the names, but when kids notice that the cafeteria workers smile at them and that they're happy, then the kids get a little bit happier and they tend to eat a little bit better. And we find this in a bunch of different situations. Wherever people tend to be happier, they're a little bit more likely to choose the fruits and vegetables and to eat foods that they feel good about and that are going to make them feel good.
I was also reading some research that you have been doing about even renaming vegetables. I guess these would be for some of the younger kids, that they might like the idea of, what, power peas or something like that.
No, that's absolutely the case. And you know, there are similar things you can do with older kids, but with younger kids, you want to make it exciting. You want to make it something that speaks to them in their language, right? So X-ray vision carrots, power peas, you know, finding something that says this is really exciting. My favorite, there was a bean burrito that was particularly healthy and kids weren't eating it. We renamed it the Big Bad Bean Burrito, and suddenly it you know, they couldn't
really
keep it on the shelves. Yeah,
and they kept eating and they kept eating it.
They kept eating it. It's those sorts of things. Believe it or not, a lot of the way we taste and the experience we have eating is in our mind. And so if you can set up a taste expectation or expectation that something is fun and exciting, it happens. And the kids will keep going back to that food.
What about the idea of taking just two bites? I mean, this might be a new vegetable or a new something that you're being asked to eat in school. Just take two bites. Is that helpful?
It can be. It's a challenge to get them to eat those first two bites in a lot of cases, but there is a good amount of research out there saying if kids are exposed in a meaningful way to a new food 4 to 5 times, it starts to be something that they'll eat on their own. They'll choose on their own. But there's always that barrier, particularly when you're talking about a large school. How do I get this kid to take the first two bites? There's not like you can punish them for not doing it in that context. It's difficult.
Let me get, looks like Mark from Phoenixville to join us on Radio Times. And Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, always
there.
A pleasure.
Thanks.
Just two quick points. The first is that I think a lot of it has to do with, and not that I agree with any kind of direct marketing to children, but I think a good amount of this would come down to the fact that sugar is marketed to children way more than healthy food is, and you know, they're gonna go with what they see. I mean, when you watch the cartoon channels, there's nothing but like candy commercials on all the time, as opposed to vegetable and fruit commercials or anything like that. I don't know. And the other thing is that with the guest talked about briefly, from what I heard, is that the profit margins for major food companies, they already are set up the way they are, and to switch it over and make it healthier would cost a lot of money. And I think that has a lot to do with why they don't do it. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I don't know whether you want to get on this, David Just. We were talking with Marion Nessel about, you know, who the people are that are supporting the School Nutrition Association. But I am curious about the whole marketing. And it is clear, right, you don't really see a lot of marketing of asparagus to children, for instance. At least not yet.
Right. Well, So let me first say, marketing is really effective, and most of the marketing out there really is for foods that aren't necessarily the things you want your kids to eat more of. But marketing is extremely effective for healthier foods, and we ran a simple experiment with young kids. These are preschool age kids where we gave them lunch, and with lunch they could choose an apple and or a cookie with their lunch. And whenever we would put a little sticker with the face of Elmo on that apple, we got about a 70% bump in consumption of the apple. If we did the same thing with the cookie, it didn't do anything, right? Absolutely nothing. And why? Well, the apple, they sort of need something to say, this is for you. We thought of you when we put this apple here. It's for kids and you can eat it. With the cookie, they've been taught all along, this is for you. This tastes good. They don't need the extra marketing. So there really is a big bang for our buck there in trying to market healthier foods to kids. And we haven't done a good job doing that at all. And to be honest, there's actually a little bit of resistance to do that because a lot of the crowd that wants our kids to eat healthier foods is also, they believe all marketing is of the devil, I guess.
Interesting. But aren't schools and even parents up against the fact that sugar and fat just taste so good?
We're always going to have that problem to deal with, that sugar and fat taste good. But there are ways to set up the choices so that, kids will eat it in moderation and they'll learn to do that by habit. You have a couple of different ways you can go about this. You can go in and you can say, we're going to take out all of the sugar and fat in our school lunches or at home or otherwise. And what tends to happen is you get that reactance.
Yeah.
But if you can find instead ways to just tilt the playing field a little bit so they only get those things when they ask them, when they seek them out, when they're going out of their way to get them, then they end up eating a lot less of that. They end up eating a lot more of the healthier items, and that starts to become their norm. And they do it without the rebellion or the pushback.
Let me get Wade from Northeast Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Wade. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. A long time ago, was a restaurant inspector, and part of the area district that I did inspections included school system, but also an extensive prison system. And your first guest mentioned institutional food service, and so I just wondered if your guest, is there anything that behaviorally operates in a prison system food service that correlates to school lunch in terms of just the behavioral factors of what is motivating prisoners to be happy with their meals in the first place, but also do they have input into it? And does any of that translate to what might improve food service in schools?
Well, it's a very interesting parallel there. I hear you chuckling there, David. Luckily, children get to get out of school at 3 or 3:30. But nonetheless, do you have any thoughts on that?
So I've got to preface this by saying I've never done any work in prison, so I don't know.
Right.
But I would, from what I know of adult behavior, I am guessing the same principles are going to apply. That people respond very positively to added choices, to things that are framed positively to them. So, try this or add this to your lunch. Would you like to have a fruit with that, right? A piece of fruit. I think the same principles will apply there because I've seen it work in other mm-hmm. institutional settings. We've worked in many of the, government offices down in Washington where their cafeterias are, and we've seen the same principles apply there. So it's while I think kids' behavior is somewhat different in that they really don't care about health because it's decades down the line when it's going to have an impact on them for the most part. When we go in and we look at adults, we get the same sorts of behavior. They really are looking at convenience and sort of visibility and what sort of things look attractive and are exciting.
Wade, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What do you think, David, about schools getting rid of vending machines and soda machines? Does that seem like a smart thing to do?
I It can be, but I think the main thing is to make them so, you know, if they are stocked with things that, you know, that are less healthy, have some items there that are healthier and have those things, you know, if possible, priced cheaper, and move those vending machines so you're not going to be running by them, you know, 10 times a day. You want them to be somewhere where somebody has to sort of walk out of their way to get to it. I realize that makes it a little less profitable, but it will make it so the kids are moderating their behavior a little better than they would if, you know, if it's full on straight out where they're going to walk between every class and it's only loaded with the chocolate bars or whatever it might be.
And final question to you, what about paying kids to eat healthy? Is that an effective approach?
Well, it's effective, yes. I don't know how politically popular it is. We did, when the new school lunch guidelines were coming out, we decided we wanted to figure out what's the impact going to be and how cost effective is it. And we tended to find out, yeah, you know, requiring the fruit or vegetable on the tray, you get about 1 out of 10 kids to eat that wouldn't otherwise. You get about 5 out of 10 that are now throwing away a fruit or vegetable that wouldn't otherwise, and it's costly. You get about, if you just pay them a nickel to eat their fruits and vegetables and don't require them to put it on their tray, it brings the waste way, way down, and the cost of it overall is about 1/10. I don't think anybody's going to be passing that through Congress anytime soon, but it is cheaper. And it shows you that it's the motivation that's the problem. It's not just the availability of the fruits and vegetables.
Well, on that note, Dave, just we could go on. We have to end our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, us as well. And that's David Just, director of the Cornell Center for Behavioral Economics and Child Nutrition Programs. He's also a professor of behavioral economics at the Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management, also at Cornell University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.